Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, December 15th, 2024. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a front page article from the Republic on deportations. Then we'll move on to a Season for Sharing article and then an article about the Kroger-Albertsons merger. This first article is entitled, I'm Worried, I'm Nervous, Trump's Election Ignites Anxiety Among Immigrants as Possible Mass Deportations Loom. This is by Daniel Gonzalez. It is a stressful time to be an immigration lawyer, almost as stressful as for the clients they serve. Since Donald Trump was elected president on November 5th, after pledging to carry out the largest mass deportations in U.S. history in response to a record number of migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, immigration attorneys say they have been flooded with calls from people afraid of being deported. The calls have come from undocumented immigrants, some who have lived in the U.S. for decades, and recent arrivals with tenuous legal status. Both groups could be the first targeted by Trump's promised mass deportation, immigration lawyers say. But immigration lawyers are also receiving calls from legal residents who had put off applying for citizenship but have been spurred by Trump's election and the fear of mass deportations to seek citizenship. Even some naturalized U.S. citizens are worried that under the new Trump administration, they could be stripped of citizenship and deported, attorneys say. Fear has been compounded, immigration attorneys say, by Arizona's passage of Proposition 314. The sweeping immigration enforcement measure, which would make illegally entering Arizona from Mexico a state crime in addition to a federal crime, and seeks to turn local authorities into immigration officers, is broader than Arizona's 2010 immigration enforcement bill, Senate Bill 1070. The passage of that law contributed to a mass exodus of immigrants from Arizona that exacerbated the Great Recession and housing crash, but was largely found to be unconstitutional by the courts. The election of Jerry Sheridan as sheriff of Maricopa County is also adding to fears, immigration lawyers say, even though Sheridan has said he does not want his deputies enforcing immigration laws. Sheridan was high up in the agency when former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio began using workplace raids and saturation patrols in largely Latino neighborhoods to go after immigrants. He and Arpaio were later found in contempt for violating a federal judge's orders in a case about the sheriff's office's unlawful practice of targeting Latino drivers. Immigration lawyers say they have tried to assuage the anxiety they are hearing from immigrants by describing some of the rhetoric from Trump officials as unrealistic and intended to sow fear so that immigrants leave the country on their own. At the same time, they are advising immigrants on how to prepare for the possibility of mass deportations. Ray Ibarra Maldonado said the fear and anxiety he has heard from clients exceeds the first Trump administration from 2017 to 2020 and during the height of Arpaio's attempts at immigration enforcement in the late 2000s and early 2010s. I'm hearing more panic, more anxiety, more stress than I've ever heard in my career as an attorney or an advocate for immigrants' rights, Ibarra Maldonado said. I think what we're going through right now mentally and the suffering our community is experiencing is almost worse than the actual deportations that I saw under Arpaio and that I saw under Trump. It's really bad. Ibarra Maldonado represented Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes, the Mesa resident, an undocumented mother of two U.S. citizen children, was deported to Mexico in February 2017, becoming the first person removed from the country after Trump was inaugurated and attempted to adopt a no-holds-barred approach to immigration enforcement. Trump deported about 1.5 million people during the 4 years of his first term, according to the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. Immigrants now fear the immigration enforcement about to be unleashed under the second Trump administration will be worse, given his post-election statements that he plans to declare a national emergency, invoke the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, and use the U.S. military to deport millions of people. People who survived the past Trump administration, they have a genuine fear that his first day in office, he's going to use the military to knock on doors and put people on buses and deport them without a chance to see a judge, without a chance to present their case in an immigration court, Ibarra Maldonado said. They literally think there's going to be military on the street arresting people day one. Some immigrants already are thinking about leaving the U.S., he said. They literally are saying, like, I'm considering going back to Mexico. I'm considering leaving the country because I'm afraid of what's going to happen, Ibarra Maldonado said. Ibarra Maldonado said he tells his clients that while their fears are legitimate, they shouldn't panic. I go through the reality of the situation, Ibarra Maldonado said. In Arizona, we survived Arpaio. We survived the first 4 years of Trump. What's more, Ibarra Maldonado said, the government doesn't have the resources to deport the millions of people Trump claims are in the country illegally, Ibarra Maldonado said. A 2024 Department of Homeland Security report estimated that as of 2022, there were about 10.9 million undocumented immigrants living in the U.S., down from nearly 11.6 million in 2018. Of the 10.9 million, about 290,000 live in Arizona, which ranks 10th among states by the number of undocumented immigrants. The report states that the 290,000 undocumented immigrants in Arizona as of 2022 were down significantly from a peak of about 560,000 in 2008. The Migration Policy Institute estimates more than 5.6 million migrants have been allowed into the U.S. under the Biden administration. The number includes asylum seekers and migrants allowed into the country by the government. These approved groups include people fleeing communist and socialist regimes in Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, people escaping political turmoil and natural disasters in Haiti, people displaced by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and Afghan refugees whose lives were in danger after the U.S. military withdrew from Afghanistan in 2021 and the Taliban regained control. ICE does not have that many buses to go and arrest that many people and send them to detention centers or send them across the border, Ibarra Maldonado said. Anybody who is a longtime resident of the country and who doesn't have a criminal history, I still don't think that there's much reason for them to be as afraid as they are. Immigration attorney, calm comes from having a plan. Some of the fear immigrants are feeling was palpable on November 21st at the headquarters of Puente, a Phoenix nonprofit that provides support to undocumented immigrants and mixed-status families, families with a mixture of immigrants without legal status and U.S. citizens. About 60 people filled a large room to learn how to prepare for the second Trump administration and Arizona's new immigration enforcement law, Proposition 314. I'm worried. I'm nervous, said Marina Fernandez, an undocumented immigrant from Mexico in her 40s, who said she has lived in Arizona since 1995 and is in the process of trying to obtain legal status. Fernandez said she has 7 children, all U.S. citizens. What I'm worried about is that I would be separated from my children, Fernandez said. But I have faith that everything will be okay. We are going to fight like we always have fought. Delia Salvatierra, an immigration lawyer, told people during the Puente meeting that Trump plans to carry out mass deportations not only with federal immigration agencies and the U.S. military, but also by enlisting the help of local and state authorities. In addition, the whole purpose of Proposition 314, she said, is to allow local police and other authorities in Arizona to take a more proactive role in helping the federal government enforce immigration laws. Proposition 314 gives local and state law enforcement the authority to arrest and detain migrants and gives state judges the power to issue deportation orders, which is now the sole legal purview of the federal government. Proposition 314 also calls for making crossing the U.S.-Mexico border outside of ports of entry a state crime. The law also imposes enhanced penalties for people convicted of selling fentanyl that leads to death and requires the use of E-Verify to access public benefits. However, the parts of Proposition 314 that hand federal immigration authority over to non-federal officials won't take effect right away, if ever. That's because federal courts will first have to decide whether similar provisions upon which Arizona's law is modeled are constitutional. Near the end of her presentation, Salvatierra turned the meeting into a class, presenting different scenarios involving the police and ICE agents and asking the audience how they would respond. "What's the first thing you are going to do?" Salvatierra said into a microphone connected to a boombox on the floor. Llorar, a woman seated in the middle of the room, said in Spanish. "Cry." The audience laughed and the tension in the room was lifted, if only for a moment. Salvatierra continued asking questions and offering legal advice. She told the audience they should start preparing a plan right away in case they or someone in their family were detained. The plan, Salvatierra said, should include who's going to take care of their children, where are their children going to stay, who's going to pick them up from school. She also suggested they memorize the phone number of a family member, relative, or friend who can act on their behalf while they are detained, and that they talk to a lawyer to determine if they qualify to apply for legal status. "This is definitely the time to do it," Salvatierra said. Salvatierra told the audience if they are stopped and questioned by local police about their immigration status, they have the right to remain silent and the right to speak to an attorney. She also said they had the right not to divulge information about their immigration status if asked. If they are turned over to immigration authorities, Salvatierra urged them not to sign any documents until they spoke to an attorney or asked to appear in front of a judge. She also said they should not lie. "That is never going to help you," she said. "Above all, remain calm," Salvatierra said. "But calm comes from having a plan." Who will the Trump administration prioritize for deportation? Yasser Sanchez, an immigration lawyer based in Mesa, said he has received over 100 phone calls, text messages, and direct messages on social media from fearful immigrants since Trump won the presidential election. "My phone has been inundated with calls," Sanchez said, "from people who want legal help to figure out what they can do to prevent themselves or a loved one from being deported." Sanchez said some of the people who have called him are U.S. citizens who were undocumented immigrants in the past and are worried they could be stripped of their citizenship and deported under the new Trump administration. Others are worried Trump could reinstitute public charge rules put in place during his first term in office that made it much harder for legal immigrants married to U.S. citizens to prove, in order to qualify for citizenship, that they would not be a burden to the government. Trump's public charge rules were discontinued when Biden took office, but Sanchez said it's likely Trump will bring them back. Sanchez said he's urging legal residents married to U.S. citizens to submit applications for citizenship with the federal government before Trump is inaugurated on January 20th and tougher rules are reinstituted. Sanchez said he believes the immigrants most vulnerable to deportations under the Trump administration will be non-wealthy minorities, beginning with Haitians who Trump has falsely and repeatedly claimed were eating other people's pets. At the same time, Sanchez said he believed Trump would ignore undocumented Canadians living in Arizona after illegally overstaying six-month temporary visitor visas. Maurice Mo Goldman, an immigration attorney based in Tucson, has also been flooded with phone calls and text messages from clients asking how to prepare for Trump's second administration. Goldman said Trump associates have stated the administration would go after immigrants with criminal records first. But Goldman said it's unclear how broadly the new administration will define criminal records. Are they saying people who came without legal papers are criminals? Goldman said. Is it people with felonies, or is it people with more insignificant criminal issues like driving without a license? Goldman said anyone already on the government's radar could also be among the first immigrants to be deported. This group would include hundreds of thousands of people from Haiti, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Ukraine, and Afghanistan allowed to enter the U.S. during the Biden administration, along with hundreds of thousands of immigrants living in the U.S. under temporary protected status because of natural disasters and armed conflicts in their home countries. It may also include people registered via DACA. Trump could attempt again to end the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that pauses government efforts to deport certain undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children and allows them to live and work temporarily in the U.S. There are approximately 580,000 DACA recipients in the U.S., including about 22,000 in Arizona. We've heard it from Trump that he wants to get rid of programs like Temporary Protected Status and DACA, and all those people are in the government's database, and their personal information is in there, like their address or their phone number, Goldman said. And so I think those are really the ones I'd be most concerned about initially, are people who are known to the government. And that article was entitled, "I'm Worried, I'm Nervous," and that was by Daniel Gonzalez. And now a Season for Sharing article entitled, "Inside the Store Where Teachers Find Supplies to Inspire." This is by Zach Bradshaw. When she started teaching, Barbie Costanza didn't know if she could afford the school supplies she needed for her students. August marked her first month teaching at East Valley Institute of Technology in Mesa. Costanza said she wanted to find extra school supplies like poster boards, whiteboards, paper, staplers, and bins for her students, but she estimated she would have spent over $500 on all of it if she had purchased from popular retail stores like Target. Costanza said she was worried about how much she would have to spend. Luckily, Costanza, a hairstylist, happened to bring up her new opportunity as a teacher with one of her clients. The client ended up being Joy Klein, who told Costanza to take a trip to Treasures for Teachers. "I was able to go there and pretty much fill the back of my SUV for $100," Costanza said. "It's an amazing resource. It makes things affordable." Empowering teachers with discounted classroom supplies. Treasures for Teachers is a nonprofit organization founded in 2004. The nonprofit provides discounted school items to teachers across the Metro Phoenix. Joy Klein, executive director of Treasures for Teachers, said the nonprofit's goal is to empower our educators and enrich our students. "Our teachers can not only offset some of the costs they're spending of their personal dollars," she said, "but make sure that students have the supplies they need in the classroom." Teachers around the valley often spend anywhere from $500 to $1,500 for supplies, according to the organization. While most schools supply teachers with a certain amount of items each academic year, it's often not enough for all the students or the length of the academic period, which is where Treasures for Teachers steps in to help out. "I think a lot of individuals don't know that teachers are spending so much out of their own pocket to support classrooms," she said. "I think it's interesting that most professions, like construction, you're given all of the items you need, whereas in teaching, often you're responsible for providing all of those materials to do your job." how to shop for supplies at two Metro Phoenix locations. There are two Treasures for Teachers locations in the Valley, each stocked full of discounted supplies. Klein listed off a few of the common items teachers can find, including pencils, markers, crayons, dry erase markers, paper, binders, post-it notes, flashcards, index cards, notebooks, composition notebooks, glue, and scissors. Treasures for Teachers also offers more expensive items like desks or computer chairs, too. Not only do the stores help educators, Klein explained, that the stores eliminate waste. When thrift stores, offices, and other spaces no longer need their office supplies, they can donate them to the group, thereby repurposing things that would normally go into the trash. Treasures for Teachers estimates 3.3 million cubic feet of material is diverted from landfills every year thanks to its services. Stepping up where Arizona education funding falls short. The state of Arizona education makes stores like Treasures for Teachers more important now than ever, Klein said. The schools right now have largely cut their supply budgets, so there's hardly anything they're even ordering at the school level, she said. Teachers feel burdened with the need to purchase classroom items, Klein said. And while teachers can choose to ask families to provide supplies for the classrooms, not every family can afford that. Klein estimates roughly 240,000 K-12 students are impacted by the group's work. The two locations are used by more than 5,000 teachers, Klein said, and thousands more have access to the mobile unit. Barbie Costanza said Treasures for Teachers has made a big difference for her students and their success. It's enhanced my ability to provide creative projects for my students, she said. How Season for Sharing is helping educators and students. Treasures for Teachers is just one of the groups that received funding from Season for Sharing to help assist educators and students. Here are a few other groups that are making a difference in the state and how Season for Sharing is helping. Arizona Autism United. This group helps children with developmental disabilities by providing life-changing early intervention services and educational support at our clinic locations in Metro Phoenix. Arizona Recreation Center for the Handicapped. This recreation center provides after-school care, education, and enrichment activities for low-income children with disabilities. Future for Kids. This group provides underserved 3rd through 6th graders in Maricopa County with mentorship and enriching after-school programming designed to build social, emotional skills and improve STEM learning. Literacy Volunteers of Maricopa County. This group works to increase literacy in Metro Phoenix, providing opportunities to adults to obtain better employment, transition into post-secondary education and job skills training, fully integrate and participate in our society, and successfully participate in the educational development of their children. National Audubon Society. Audubon provides long-term, hands-on nature education for hundreds of underserved children outside of schools while making science real, relevant, and memorable. Sandra Day O'Connor Institute for American Democracy. This organization educates middle school and high school students about civics. How to donate to Season for Sharing. There are several ways you can donate to Season for Sharing and help organizations like Scottsdale Arts continue to help the community. Fill out the secure online form at sharing.azcentral.com. Text SHARING to 91-999 and click on the link in the text message. Go online at facebook.com/seasonforsharing and look for the featured Donate Here post. Clip the coupon on page 4A of the Arizona Republic, fill it out, and mail it to P.O. Box 29250, Phoenix, Arizona, 85038-9250. And that article was entitled Supplies to Inspire, and that was by Zach Bradshaw. Our next article is entitled What Kroger-Albertsons Merger News Means for You. This is by Mary Jo Pitzel. Two federal court rulings this week blocked the proposed Kroger-Albertsons $25 billion supermarket mega-merger, meaning the chains will continue to operate separately. Meanwhile, Albertsons has sued Kroger, alleging the company held back on information that could have bolstered the argument for a merger. With the weekly grocery ads released Wednesday, it's time to explore what these court rulings mean for the average shopper. What will happen to my grocery bill? It's hard to predict at this early date, but proponents of the merger argued it would help drive down costs by combining the buying power of two major grocery chains. That would translate into lower prices, they believed. Critics, however, said a merger would drive prices up, among other things. That's because customers would have fewer options with a merged company. That's the position Attorney General Chris Mays took when she applauded the court rulings that temporarily blocked the proposed merger. Had this merger gone forward, it could have harmed families by reducing choices, driving up prices, and eliminating jobs, she said in a statement sent by her office. Barack Orbach, a law professor at the University of Arizona, said consumers should brace for a loss of some sort, although not necessarily in prices. Americans want fresh food, lower prices, and convenience when it comes to their food supply. But, he said, achieving all three goals requires massive scale, which could be brought on by consolidation. Something has to give, Orbach said. Doug Ross, a law professor at the University of Washington, said he doesn't expect anything to change on the price front, at least in the short run. In a market where Kroger is saying it needs to gear up to face a new wave of competition from non-traditional grocery purveyors such as Walmart, Amazon, and Target, raising prices would be a foolish move, he said. Could the Kroger-Albertsons merger be revived? No one expects that, particularly the two grocery chains. The merger is dead, Ross said. That was made clear when Albertsons immediately sued Kroger in the wake of Tuesday's court rulings. Not only does Albertsons want the $600 million breakup fee that was part of the merger agreement, the company is seeking billions from Kroger to compensate for its costs over the last 2 years as the merger talk progressed. Albertsons feels it has suffered more damages than the merger's failure, Ross said. It wants billions, he added, citing the unspecified amount Albertsons referenced in its lawsuit. Although the two court rulings were only preliminary injunctions, not final judgments, there's no reason to think the merger will revive, given the acrimony arising from the merger, Ross said. Who's bigger in Arizona, Albertsons or Kroger? The two are about equal. Kroger has 124 stores in Arizona, most of them operating as Fry's Food and Drug. It has 19,851 workers on its Arizona payroll, according to the Arizona Republic 100, which ranks the state's largest businesses. Albertsons has 134 stores, mostly running under the Safeway banner, but a handful operating as Albertsons. It employs about 14,500 people statewide, according to the Republic 100 report. Kroger initiated the merger, seeking to absorb Albertsons into its suite of stores. Although Fry's and Safeway Albertsons are big players in the Arizona market, nationally they are far outpaced by Walmart, Amazon, and Costco. And that article was entitled What Kroger-Albertsons Merger News Means for You, and that was by Mary Jo Pitzel. We're approximately 29 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, December 15th, 2024. We're going to move on to Valley and State News with an inspiration article from the Republic entitled Song of the Heavens with the subtitle Grand Canyon Astronomer Explores Space, Time, and Music. This is by Lane Sainty. More than 99% of Americans live under skies polluted by light. This pervasive artificial glow obscures stars and the constellations they form. It hides our galaxy, the Milky Way, from 4 in every 5 people living in the U.S. It disrupts our circadian rhythms, which dictate our sleep and wake cycles, and has a deleterious effect on plant and animal life. The astronomer Dr. David Koerner thinks it also affects our sense of place in the universe. Seeing the galaxy in which you live and understanding that it's there and understanding that your place in the world is not just your place among your work associates or whatever, he said, it's in this huge cosmos at large. Koerner, a retired Northern Arizona University professor, recently lived at the Grand Canyon for 6 weeks as the park's astronomer-in-residence, a position created to promote dark sky education and awareness. Grand Canyon National Park was named an International Dark Sky Park in 2019. To earn and keep the certification, it retrofitted thousands of lights to reduce glare and shine downward and maintains a certain level of sky quality. It is among 148 dark sky places in the U.S., many of them concentrated in the Southwest. Some call these places home or live under uncertified expanses of dark sky. But most only experience the full grandeur of an unpolluted night sky through a screen, a photo on social media, an episode of Star Trek, the special effects of a science fiction film. I think that gives people the idea that the universe is CGI, Koerner said. But then they visit some place where the sky is actually visible. During Koerner's stint at the North Rim, he was out stargazing with tourists. One woman, visiting from the East Coast, was visibly astonished as she stared up at the sky. "We can't see any of this," she said in wonder, "but it's all there." And to Koerner, it offers a view of deep time that is just as profound and moving as that found in the Grand Canyon. "Deep time is 3 times longer in space than on Earth," he said, "because the universe is 3 times as old." And that article was entitled Song of the Heavens, and that was by Lane Sainty. Our next article is entitled What Cold Weather Does to Your Car, with the subtitle How to Prepare for Changes in Weather. This is by Haley Evans. As temperatures drop, it's the time of year when your car's tire pressure lights come on or heat-stricken batteries don't start during colder nights or frosty winter vacations. While Phoenix doesn't experience harsh winters like other parts of the country, drivers should still prepare for seasonal weather changes and winter road trips. Shahi Kulakian owns Mazvo, an auto care center in Phoenix, and says it's important for desert drivers to be proactive before embarking on trips north. "The owner needs to self-advocate," Kulakian said. "Ask yourself, how old is my vehicle? If it's 3 to 5 or more years old, it's crucial to look at several things. Here's everything to know about winterizing your vehicle as the weather cools across the state. Battery. Check its age and charge. Anyone who has lived and driven in Phoenix long enough knows that car batteries have a half-life in America's hottest big city. It's one of the first things residents should check in the winter. Number one, especially in Arizona, is the temperature shock the battery goes through," Kulakian said. "Most people forget how old it is until the day they have to jump rather than being proactive always to check. Most car batteries have a round sticker on the side listing 2 numbers, the month and the year. If a car battery is 2 or more years old, Kulakian suggests taking the vehicle to an auto shop to test the battery. If it comes back 40 or 50% weaker, that's where you're going to self-advocate to say, well, if I don't replace this battery, I'm going to get stuck," he said. Tires, age, and inflation. The next thing Kulakian suggests checking before embarking on a trip through the mountains is the vehicle's tires. "Again, a lot of people are not going to know how old their tire is," he said. "The rule of thumb federal mandate says any tire that is 5 years or older, you've got to replace them for dry rotting. Drivers can check their tire sidewall for numbers that indicate the week number. The week of January 1st would be 1, for example, and the year to see how old it is. If a tire reads 12/19, it was manufactured during the week of March 18, 2019, and would need to be replaced. On long road trips, especially during the colder months, tire rubber expands and retracts. Koulakian said after driving a few hours on the freeway, the rubber expands and tires can inflate 2 to 3 psi. Once travelers arrive at their destination, say Flagstaff, and the car is parked in the cold overnight, the rubber shrinks and the psi decreases. It's still important to check your tires whenever tire pressure warnings occur, but in these situations, it's likely normal with weather changes. Coolant. It needs antifreeze. While residents don't have to worry about deep freezes in Phoenix, if they drive to Flagstaff or Sholo, their vehicle's coolant could freeze if it is diluted. Koulakian advises drivers to bring their vehicles to an auto shop to ensure the water glycol ratio is correct for the make and model of the car. Wipers, replace if they're old and dry. Windshield wipers may not get much use in Phoenix, but drivers should get them before heading to wetter areas. Wiper blades are really important to monitor as well, Koulakian said. We never have rain here, and when we do, everybody has to replace them. When windshield wipers are dormant and sitting on scorching windshields during the summer, they can dry out. Sometimes their only exposure to water is at the car wash. Wipers can dry rot and the rubber becomes hard and brittle. They can leave streaks on the glass, malfunction, fall apart, or damage the windshield. Windshield wiper fluid can also freeze in cold temperatures, but drivers can purchase specific fluid that works in all seasons. Be proactive. Even after checking a vehicle's tires, battery, coolant, and other parts prone to malfunction during the winter, Koulakian advises caution whenever traveling north to possibly dangerous weather and road conditions. It's very important to have an emergency kit when driving up north, Koulakian said. Get a box and throw in some flares, blankets, batteries, a good flashlight, and jumper cables. He also suggests writing down important phone numbers and emergency contacts on a piece of paper and placing it in the glove box in case the driver's phone dies during a breakdown. Checking the weather and printing a map of the route with gas stations and rest areas highlighted will prevent surprises during a road trip. Koulakian also recommends drivers visit an auto shop before their winter vacations to ensure their vehicle can make the journey. And that article is entitled, What Cold Weather Does to Your Car, and that was by Haley Evans. Our next article is entitled, Holiday Show Celebrates Connections, Nostalgia, and Joy. This is by Sylvia Solis. 6 community members will share heartfelt holiday stories as part of the cherished tradition of bringing personal life experiences to the stage through the Arizona Storytellers Project. The Holiday Show is set for 7 p.m. Tuesday, December 17th at Tempe Center for the Arts. Tickets are $12 and can be purchased at tempecenterforthearts.com. This live storytelling show celebrates the spirit of connection, nostalgia, and joy that defines the holidays, bringing people together to laugh, reflect, and embrace the season's magic, said Melissa Sosa-Fees, faculty member at the South Mountain Community College's Storytelling Institute and project co-lead. It's the holiday performance that the whole family will love. The annual holiday show concludes the 2024 series. It included shows on themes such as love and friendship, neighbors and civic participation, which was featured in the project's second bilingual show. Republic Journalists and the South Mountain Community College Storytelling Institute curate and coach the storytelling events. The show joins the Arizona Republic Season for Sharing campaign to celebrate the holidays in the spirit of community unity. Now, in its 31st year, Season for Sharing has raised more than $74 million since 1993 to support local nonprofits, earning its place as the largest holiday fundraising campaign in the state. Tellers scheduled for the show are Miranette Robinson, who was born and raised in Mississippi, remembers listening to her grandfather tell family stories, something he did with lightness and humor. As she takes the stage for the second time as an Arizona Storytellers presenter, she will bring that same charm, inviting the audience to share lessons that prove again and again that we are more alike than different. Rebecca Love, a high school teacher, will reflect on the power of family traditions and the memories that shape us. Her story centers on a meaningful Christmas, a special gift, and two milestones that align in a way only the holidays could make possible. Rochelle and Chrissy Dart, a daughter-mother duo, will come together to share their passion for timeless stories inspired by characters that endure hardship and transform gritty truths into the magic of the holidays, helping the audience discover what it means to be human. Rafael Carranza Arroyo, another returning presenter, will take the stage as a storyteller after hosting the event several times. A former Arizona Republic reporter, he will share how holidays took on new meaning early in his journalism career far from home and the ability of the holiday season to transform strangers into family. Giovanna Avias, a Mexican-born artist and arts educator, will guide the audience through a journey of resilience and gratitude, reflecting on the sacrifices her parents made to bring magic to the holiday season, even amid change. Through her story, we'll be reminded of seeing the beauty in what others take for granted. Arizona Storytellers Holidays is at the Tempe Center for the Arts, 700 West Rio Salado Parkway in Tempe, on Tuesday, December 17, 2024. The show begins at 7 p.m. Drinks and snacks will be available at the lobby bar starting at 6 p.m. Tickets are $12 and can be purchased online or at the door. Shows typically sell out fast, so advance purchase is recommended. Go to TempeCenterForTheArts.com. And that article is entitled Holiday Show Celebrates Connections, Nostalgia, and Joy. And that was by Sylvia Solis. Now an article from the archives section of the paper. This is entitled, Take a Peek at Life in 1910s Arizona. This is by Shelby Slade. It might be hard to imagine what Metro Phoenix looked like more than 100 years ago while you navigate rush hour traffic or glimpse the many skyscrapers that compose our city's skyline. In the Grand Canyon State, the 1910s were a decade of progress. A dam tamed the Salt River, Arizona officially became a state, and Phoenix began to pave streets. The Arizona Republic Archives show what the 1910s were like in Metro Phoenix. Take a step back in time to see what the pivotal decade looked like in the Grand Canyon State, including a visit from Theodore Roosevelt, early scenes of downtown Phoenix, and the construction of historic hotels. Here are several big events that happened in the 1910s in Arizona. Arizona became a state. Arizona had tried to reach statehood for years. It didn't officially happen until February 14, 1912, when Arizona became the 48th state. To become a state, officials had to drop a clause from the state's constitution that allowed for judges to be recalled, though it was among the legislature's first orders of business. Women were also granted the right to vote. Salt River Dam built to aid growing towns. The Roosevelt Dam on the Salt River was completed in 1911 and named after former President Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt visited Arizona for the dedication, commenting on the southwestern state's sacrifice during the Spanish-American War. If there could be any monument which would appeal to any man, surely this is it. You could not have done anything which would have pleased and touched me more than to name this great dam, this reservoir site, after me, and I thank you from my heart for having done so, he said. World War I. America entered World War I in 1917. Frank Luke Jr., a native of Phoenix, enlisted in the fight. The next year, the pilot would take down 9 enemy hot air balloons in 3 days, a feat given how well defended the balloons typically were. Luke later died after he was wounded in heavy fire. He was forced to land his plane, though he continued to fire on enemy troops, some of whom were injured or killed. He received a posthumous Medal of Honor. And that article is entitled Take a Peek at Life in 1910s Arizona, and that was by Shelby Slade. We're going to move on now to national and world news with news from USA Today, with two front page articles, one on Syria and the next on drone sightings. The first article on Syria, this is called This Was the Graveyard, with the subtitle At Location of Suspected Mass Killings, Syrians Recall Horrors, Hope for Answers. This is by Maya Gabili. A hip bone in a blown-out building, a a part of a spine amid some debris, a few foot bones, and a worn-out sock. The Tadamon district of Damascus is littered with bones after what residents and rights groups described as years of killings there under the rule of Syria's Bashar Assad. Tadamon became infamous after a video emerged in 2022 showing a man in military fatigues leading unarmed, blindfolded men toward a large ditch, telling them to run and shooting them at point-blank range as they neared the edge or after they fell in. The incident took place in 2013, but the killings went on until very recently, residents told Reuters, saying they had regularly seen Syrian security forces bring men to the area, heard bursts of gunshots, and smelled burning flesh afterward. Mohammed Aldara, an elderly man from Tadamon, said he had stayed in the neighborhood after the civil war began in 2011 because his family was afraid their apartment would be looted. He said that year after year he saw cars driven by Syrian armed forces bring tied-up people to a tiny alley parallel to where the Tadamon massacre is thought to have taken place. At night you would hear it. Every shot fired went into a man, he said. Pointing to the dirt street and the gutted-out buildings alongside it, he added, and this was the graveyard for all the corpses. Reuters found bones piled amid trash, scorched plastic, and dirty clothes in both of the buildings on either side, and saw children playing with what appeared to be rib bones and femurs. Khaled Huria, who runs a mechanic shop in the area, said he too had often heard gunshots and smelled burning flesh after returning to the neighborhood in 2019. This was known as Execution Street. Anyone who came to this street was considered lost, he said, adding that security forces often asked his neighbors to help them dig mass graves. Those things won't leave our memory. Corpses all over the floor. It became normal for people, Huria said. Too scared to speak. The residents said they had not dared to speak out during Assad's rule, when criticism of the authorities was severely repressed. Some remained hesitant and spoke only with a first name, declining to be filmed. We couldn't say anything, otherwise they would burn your house down or kill your son. It was ugly, 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 Dara said. But now, a week after Assad's ouster, residents and rights researchers hope the site can be cordoned off and those responsible for the killings held accountable. It is urgent that this location is secured, that the mass grave is exhumed, that international relevant bodies are allowed unhindered access to this area to be able to do this work carefully, cautiously, and well, said Hiba Ziyadin, the Syria researcher at advocacy group Human Rights Watch. Ziyadin said there was a risk that the mass grave had already been emptied by the forces of Assad's toppled government. Families deserve to know what happened here, she said. Hundreds of thousands of Syrians are estimated to have been killed since 2011, when Assad's crackdown on protests against him spiraled into a full-scale war that drew in regional powers. Both Assad and his father Hafez, who preceded him as president and died in 2000, have been accused by rights groups and governments of widespread extrajudicial killings, including mass executions within the country's notorious prison system. Assad repeatedly denied carrying out violations and painted his detractors as terrorists. In 2023, the U.S. State Department issued a travel ban against a Syrian security official and his immediate family over his alleged killing of at least 41 civilians in 2013 in Tadamon, calling it a massacre. The suspected location of the grave was identified by researchers at Human Rights Watch by matching satellite imagery with the scene in the video. While a full examination of the site has yet to take place, the group has already found many traces of killings. We found human remains, bones, part of a skull, fingers, ribs, strewn around the entire area surrounding the mass grave, which shows that really a lot more happened here than what we already know, Ziyadin said. Residents of Tadamon told Reuters the alley had been sealed off with metal barricades during years of heavy fighting between rebel fighters and Syrian government forces, including the National Defense Forces, a pro-Assad paramilitary force that was incorporated into the army in 2012. Several said that earlier this year they saw Syria's then-government forces remove some bones from the area and feared the grave and evidence had been dug up. The opening of Syria's prisons after Assad's ouster last Sunday led to similar fears, with activists and families searching for detained relatives, saying they feared troops had destroyed evidence. And that article was entitled, "This Was the Graveyard," by Maya Gabelli. Now our next front page article from USA Today is entitled, "Officials, Most Drone Sightings Are Manned Aircraft," with a subtitle, "Stress No Evidence of National Security Threat." This is by Andrea Shalal. Officials from the White House, FBI, and Department of Homeland Security on Saturday stressed that most of the recent reported drone sightings in New Jersey and nearby states involved manned aircraft, and there is no evidence of any national security threat. An FBI official told reporters during an impromptu briefing that the agency was working with 50 local, state, and federal partners to look into increased reports. The official said less than 100 of the over 5,000 reported sightings had turned out to merit further investigation, and all of the large fixed-wing reported sightings so far involved manned aircraft. The combination of efforts so far to include technical equipment, tip line information, and noted consults has not found any evidence to support large-scale unmanned aerial systems activities, the official said, adding that many of the sightings occurred along regular flight paths. Extensive efforts were underway to investigate the remaining cases, using interviews and analyses of radar and intelligence, the official added. "We can't ignore the sightings that have been there," the official said. "We're doing our best to find the origin of those drone activities, but I think there has been a slight overreaction." A spate of reported drone sightings that began in New Jersey in mid-November spread in recent days to include Maryland, Massachusetts, and other states. The sightings have garnered media attention and prompted creation of a Facebook page called "New Jersey Mystery Drones, Let's Solve It," with 56,000 online members. President Joe Biden is receiving regular updates on the issue, a White House official said. On Cape Cod in Massachusetts, residents and a police officer in Harwich reported seeing 10 to 15 drones flying in the Friday night sky, the Boston Herald reported. Police relayed the information to the Boston FBI and Massachusetts State Police. Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey said on Facebook that she is also aware of a growing number of drone sightings across Massachusetts and we're monitoring the situation closely. New York Governor Kathy Hochul on Saturday called for a boost in federal law enforcement efforts after the runways at a local airport in the Hudson Valley were shut down for 1 hour due to drone activity on Friday. "This has gone too far," Hochul said in a statement on the social media network X, urging the Biden administration to boost law enforcement in New York and other areas and calling on Congress to pass drone reform legislation. An official with the Federal Aviation Administration said a temporary ban on drone activity had been put in place over Picatinny Arsenal, a military base in Wharton, New Jersey, that was due to expire on December 26th and could be made permanent. There had been drone sightings over Picatinny and other naval weapons station in December, a military official told reporters, but there's no intelligence or observation that they were linked to a foreign actor or had malicious intent. Drone operations over military installations are generally banned, but occur from time to time, the official added. A second ban was put in place over Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey, that was due to expire on December 20th, but could be extended, the FAA official said. And that article was entitled, "Officials, Most Drone Sightings Are Manned Aircraft," and that was by Andrea Shalal. And now from the In Brief section of USA Today, we have some brief news. Rhode Island hit by data breach as hackers demand ransom. hundreds of thousands of Rhode Island residents' personal and bank information, including Social Security numbers, were very likely hacked by an international cybercriminal group asking for a ransom, state officials said on Saturday. In what Rhode Island officials described as extortion, the hackers threatened to release the stolen information unless they were paid an undisclosed amount of money. The breached data affects people who use the state's government assistance programs and includes the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and health care purchased through the state's HealthSource RI, Governor Dan McKee announced. Hackers gained access to RI Bridges, the state's online portal for obtaining social services, earlier this month, the governor's office said in a statement. But the breach was not confirmed by its vendor, Deloitte, until Friday. At least four people killed in shooting in northern France. Two security agents and two migrants were killed in a shooting in Lune Plage near the northern city of Dunkirk, French media reported on Saturday, citing security sources. A 22-year-old man turned himself in to nearby authorities following the shooting, saying he had been the attacker and had also killed a fifth person in a nearby town earlier in the day, according to French media. Authorities found three more weapons in the man's car, French media reported. It was not immediately clear what the motives were for the attack. Lune Plage, located about 6 miles from the English Channel, is the site of a migrant camp. Iran currency slips to new lows amid tensions with U.S., Europe. The Iranian currency extended its fall on Saturday, hitting a new all-time low against the U.S. dollar amid uncertainties about Donald Trump's imminent arrival in the White House and tensions with the West over Tehran's nuclear program. The rial plunged to 756,000 to the dollar on the unofficial market on Saturday, compared to 741,500 rials on Friday, according to bondbas.com, which reports exchange rates. The Bazaar360.com website said the dollar was being sold for about 755,000 reals. The dollar had been gaining against the rial since trading around 690,000 reals in early November, amid concerns that once inaugurated in January, Trump would reimpose his maximum pressure policy against Iran with tougher sanctions and empower Israel to strike Iranian nuclear sites. Iran's currency again declined after the Board of Governors of the UN Nuclear Agency, IAEA, passed a European proposed resolution against Tehran, increasing the risk of new sanctions. And that concludes all the news that we have time for from USA Today and in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, December 15th, 2024. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now you can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. You can also hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.